animal way with the two wings, and we're just going to replace the ultimate bodhicitta piece with the guided meditation from Ken MacLeod. And I did email that to everybody a couple of weeks ago. You don't need to have it to do this meditation, but if you don't have it, if you missed it somehow, and you would like me to send it again, please let me know. It's a lovely meditation on beginning to look at the nature of mind. So we'll start by checking in with our posture, if we haven't done that already. Straight spine, straightening the channels through which the energy moves, which helps to bring the mind to rest. And otherwise, you know, making sure we're grounded with our feet on the floor and our hands on our thighs or in the meditation mudra, etc. Our eyes can be closed or open for this. And we just let our minds settle into being aware of our body as well as our mind, really being grounded in our physical presence in this present moment of awareness. And within this state of grounded awareness, we will review the four thoughts, the precious human existence, remembering and appreciating how lucky we are to have everything we need to study the Dharma in this lifetime at this moment, and resolving to make use of it and not waste it. And then second, impermanence and death, realizing that we may have a limited time. We don't know how much time we have with these conditions to free ourselves from samsara, so we have to make use of it now. And then third, remembering how important our actions are. According to the law of karma, our future is determined by our actions in this lifetime. So we want to avoid harmful actions, engage in positive, helpful actions, and especially practice the Dharma, study, contemplate, and meditate on the Dharma to free ourselves from samsara while we have this chance. And then fourth, lest we think that there's any corner of samsara where we might have a better life, remembering the perils of samsara, that everything is like the proverbial razor blade with honey on the edge. It looks like even the things that look like happiness and pleasure lead to suffering. So we want to free ourselves rather than aim for a better, you know, more wealthy, you know, et cetera, samsaric life, aim for liberation. And then we request the blessings of the Lama or the Buddha, visualizing them, the Lama or the Buddha, any Lama that we feel the most connection with, or the Buddha, on the crown of our head, floating on a lotus and moon seat, above the crown of our head in a body of light, really there, vividly there. Even if we can't visualize clearly, we can think clearly that they're really there, really with us in this room at this moment, eager to empower our practice, radiating love, radiating compassion, radiating awakeness. And we informally request their blessing to empower our practice so that we can attain the same level of ability to benefit all beings. And just by our requesting it with a sincere attitude and sincere intention, we receive the blessing. The Lama and the Buddha are very happy that we're doing this. And then we visualize that they descend through our crown and come to rest in our heart center, continuing to radiate light, love, compassion, and awakening. And we can remember any time that they are present there with us and mix our mind with theirs. So taking a moment to mix our mind with the mind of the Lama, the mind of the Buddha, meaning that we simply tune into the mind of awakening, which they represent. And we can follow our breath for a few rounds if we need to bring our mind more to rest, to be ready to explore the nature of mind. A little shine at the beginning. Or just rest in open awareness if you don't feel that you need to focus on the breath. And that begins Ken's meditation as well. Begin your session by following the breath for a few slow, relaxed breaths, just as it is, letting the mind and body settle naturally. Again, keeping some of our attention in our body and what it actually feels like in this moment. And then we'll skip the first part because we all know by now that this is not a thought process that he's inviting us to do. So we're going to skip the analysis and the trying to figure out how to answer the questions and know that we just look and rest. So first we bring an image to mind or a thought. Could be words, could be a picture. If you can't think of something off the top of your head, so to speak, Chinrezig would be good, or Tara. And just look at it without thinking. Just be aware of that image, as vivid as it can be, but remaining relaxed. And we ask ourselves, with or without words, we ask ourselves, where is that image? Where is that thought located? Without thinking about it, just looking to see. Just like if we wanted to know where our keys were, we wouldn't go through a thought process necessarily, but we would go to the place we thought they might be, and we would just look. And we'd see very quickly if they were there or not. So again, looking at that image or thought, where is it located? And Ken says, you cannot say. There is no answer that can be put into words or concepts. We can't define what it is. And so that's probably what we're all seeing. And now we're being assured that that is really the way it is. We really are seeing accurately. We cannot say. Just rest there. Rest there and not being able to say. Resting and gently looking. Still aware of the image or the thought. At peace with not being able to say where it is, and resting there. Very relaxed. So now we let go of the image or thought, and we're just resting. And then we can bring up a feeling, an emotion, if you already have one. You're just stressed about something or worried about something or angry about something or feeling love or joy or compassion. Just bring that to mind. If there's nothing immediately there, then just, you know, bring up one of those feelings, any emotion. And feel that emotion in your heart, in your body. And then you ask, we ask, where is it? Where is this feeling located? So we might first notice physical sensations. If we're angry, our chest might tighten, our breath might tighten. If we're joyful, our heart might feel very expansive and full. So we want to distinguish the physical sensations from the feeling of the emotion. Are they the same or are they different? If there's more to it than the physical sensations. And if we are aware of the emotion as, you know, separate, sort of more than just the physical sensations, we ask, where is that emotion? The physical sensations are easy to locate. Where is the actual emotion? And again, not a thought process. We just look and we see where it is. Gently looking, gently resting. And again, Ken says, you cannot say where it is. No one can. Just rest there in not being able to say where it is. Rest there looking and resting. And let the emotion go wherever it wants to go. You don't have to hold on to it. It can stay or it can dissipate. Just looking steadily and gently. In a relaxed way. And then we completely let go of that, just resting. And now we look at an object, anything that's within our field of vision, large or small. And we ask, where are we seeing this object? Where is the seeing taking place? Is the seeing in our head? If the object is larger than our head, how can the seeing be in our head? And again, it's not a thought process. We're not being asked to come up with the right answer. We're just looking and asking, how can it be in my head if it's big, if it's a mountain, if it's a tonka? And you can say that it's in your mind, but that's not really like the question. It is in our mind because we learned that everything is our mind. But where is this seeing actually taking place of this object? And again, we cannot say. So we just look and rest in that space where the question is present, but we're completely relaxed with not being able to answer it. And then the final exercise, letting go of the object, the visual object. If there are any sounds, and there obviously are since I'm talking, any sounds in my voice or any other sound, let's just sit in receptivity to that sound, hearing it. And we ask the same question, where is the hearing taking place? Is it in our ear? Does our ear go out or our mind go out? Does the hearing go out to where the sound is coming from? We cannot say, so we just rest and listen. Any sound that comes up, same thing. We can very briefly touch upon where is it located and then just let it go. And then actually this is the final one. We ask who or what experiences this? Who's hearing the sound? Who's seeing the object? Who's feeling the emotion? Is there someone there? Again, just resting and looking, not figuring it out. Looking directly to see who's hearing the sound. And then we can let the looking go, not looking at anything, but just remaining in this awareness and resting. So now within this state of resting awareness, of relaxed alertness, of expansive awareness, very vast awareness, letting our minds be aware of how vast the scope of our awareness is. We go back to following our breath, breathing in and breathing out. And we begin to associate the in-breath with taking away the suffering of all the sentient beings who fill this vast, limitless space. Breathing in all of their suffering, including our own. Letting it dissolve along with the breath in our vast Buddha nature and space. And breathing out happiness, peace, healing, and whatever is needed for every sentient being. And we'll continue to do that for a minute or so on every set of breaths or every few sets of breaths, whatever's comfortable. You can rest in between if you want. Not just an abstract sort of mental exercise, but really feeling in our heart this wish to free beings from suffering and to fill them with our own happiness. And thinking that we're really accomplishing it through our meditation. humans, animals, gods, almost gods, hungry ghosts, hell beings, all of them. Specific people or groups of people or animals, particular howls, whatever comes to mind, breathing in all of the suffering fearlessly, knowing that we just let it dissolve into space and breathing out happiness and healing, breathing out love and compassion. And then taking a moment to think that we have, that all beings are free from suffering, including ourselves, and we're all filled with happiness and joy, and we are all completely awakened. And resting in that for a moment. And we're letting go of any visualization or conceptuality, any thoughts. Just coming back to open awareness or following the breath, whatever is more comfortable. And now coming back slowly to a state of mind for studying and and discussion. I'm going to share the screen. And we are going to do, because we have so many wonderful things to work with today about verse 23, we're just going to chant, we're not going to chant all the verses today. We're going to chant selected verses, starting with the preliminaries, because it's very important to keep those in mind, keep them going. So we'll first do the seven preliminary verses. This precious human life so hard to find, its freedoms and resources like a boat to navigate samsara's endless sea and set myself and other beings free, for that without distraction day and night to study, contemplate, and meditate. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. While those I love can stir up a tsunami and those I hate can burn me up like fire, when I don't care, I lose my moral compass, and dark delusion permeates my mind. To leave behind my habits and reactions, this homeland where I've dwelt from life to life, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. When I avoid conditions that disturb me, emotional afflictions lose their strength. When there are no distractions to engage me, my dharma practice grows to fill the space. Awareness knowing Rigpa clarifies, and certainty in Dharma dawns and thrives, on solitude and silence to rely. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. And we're going to revisit 3 and 4 today. So let's really keep the meaning of verse 4 in mind in preparation for verse 23. Old friends I've known as long as I remember, one day we'll have to go our separate ways. Material possessions I've worked hard for will be enjoyed by someone else one day. This consciousness a guest will leave my body, the guest house where for all my life it stayed. To let go of attachment to this lifetime, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. When I'm with friends who strengthen the three poisons, reflection, study, meditation, fade, kindness and compassion are forgotten, and I'm caught up again in worldly aims. Not following the friends who harm my practice, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. When I rely on spiritual friends, my faults and negative behaviors wane, constructive qualities and skills expand, just like the brilliance of the waxing moon. to hold authentic friends like this more dear than even my own physical welfare. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. And can the worldly deities protect themselves imprisoned in samsara's jail? The three jewels which embody freedom's path, reliable protection without fail, to seek refuge in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. So that completes the preliminaries. We're going to do verse 11, which is the heart, the core of action bodhicitta, exchanging self for other. The source of every single suffering is wishing for my happiness alone, while focusing on others' benefit gives rise to Buddhahood awakening. Because of this, to genuinely trade my happiness for others' suffering, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. So we all know the bodhisattva boot camp situations. So we're going to skip those today. Skip 20. We're going to do 21 because it too relates very directly to verse 23. Sense pleasures and desire are like salt water. The more I drink them in, the more I crave. Therefore, the moment that attachment stirs, to drop it right away without a pause. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. Verse 23 is going to tell us how to do that. How do you drop it without a pause? It's going to give us a process for that. And we'll do 22 through 24, the ultimate bodhicitta verses. All appearances are my own mind. Mind's nature from the start is concept free. To know exactly this and not engage in grasping signs of subject and object, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. When I encounter something that's delightful, such as a rainbow on a summer day, to give up all attachment to its beauty and never cling to it is truly real. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. So this is our verse today. We'll do it two more times, really tuning into the meaning. When I encounter something that's delightful, such as a rainbow on a summer day, to give up all attachment to its beauty and never cling to it is truly real. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. When I encounter something that's delightful, such as a rainbow on a summer day, to give up all attachment to its beauty and never cling to it is truly real. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. And we'll do 24 to complete the set, even though we are not going to discuss 24 today specifically. It's the other side of the coin. First one is, what do you do when you with good experiences? And 24 is, what do you do with bad experiences? All forms of suffering are just like dreaming that my beloved child has passed away. Appearances like these are just delusions. To take them as true drains my energy. When I encounter adverse circumstances, to see them as delusions of my mind, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. Okay. Does anybody have anything to say or ask before we look at the commentaries? Yes, Angela, I'm going to unmute you.
Okay. I'm having to leave early because we're in the middle of a retreat. We're on break.
Oh, so gosh.
Make your mind practice. Goes along with it. You hear Tracy?
We inspire her to put you on the big screen here very soon.
We want you to come here.
That too. We also want them to read the class.
Yeah.
But we've been.
Hi, everybody. Okay. Angela, can you be close to the screen when you speak, and if you have anything else further to say?
Okay, yes.
Great.
That's good. I just wanted to let you know that.
Great. Thank you. Hello, and who all is there with you?
Tracy there? And Max and Jay and Tom and Lama Karma and a nice lady named Dajit, and whoever shows Zelsa.
A bunch of other people.
Yeah.
Hi to everybody. Welcome to our group for however long you're staying. Anybody else have anything? Dan, did you have something to say? Oh, just waving?
Okay. Yeah.
All right. All right, anybody else? All right. Then we're going to look at verse 23. So you will recall that verse 22 is the meditation verse. Let's see, do I have my verses out? Yeah, so all appearances are my own mind. This is what we do as meditation. We practice it on the cushion or the chair. This is how we practice connecting with the nature of mind, the true nature of how things really exist. All appearances are my own mind. Mind's nature from the start is concept free. To know exactly this and not engage in grasping signs of subject and object. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. So we studied that verse last week, and as we heard from Kenpo Sultram Jamsa Rinpoche and others, it means that we give up. In meditation, we start to learn to let go of the distinction between subject and object and rest in a what's called a non-dualistic state. And we're all experienced enough to know pretty much what that means. So we can also apply that in daily life. You know, we need to practice it on the cushion, but we can apply it to anything, any experiences that arise. And verses 23 and 24 give us some pointers to how to connect with the way things really are as we go through our life and experience positive things and negative things. So we're going to start with Nyingbo Chenzei's commentary. It's very short commentary, and I'm just going to read a little bit of it because we have some very nice other commentaries, including at the end, we're going to take some time for a more general overview from Pema Chödrön, following her commentary on the last set of verses. She takes some questions, which this is from a seminar she gave at Omega Center in 2016. She took some questions, and there's three of them that are just fabulous for how to get an overview of what it means to apply all of this in the real world. So that'll be what we do after we look at Dingo Chensei and Tempo Sultan Jamso Rinpoche and a little bit from Ken MacLeod. So Dingo Chensei says, first of all, the verse is, when I encounter something that's delightful, any pleasurable thing that we might encounter in our experience, and the example given is a rainbow on a summer day, and we've talked before about seeing everything as a rainbow, like just think, if you can just bring to mind, it's just the same as a rainbow, see, you know, everything, the cup of tea is a rainbow, and the, you know, truck you have to jump out of the way from is a rainbow. It really helps to stay connected with the underlying reality of all of our experiences. So when I encounter something that's delightful, such as a rainbow on a summer day, to give up all attachment to its beauty and never cling to it as truly real, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. So he says, there is nothing definitive about obtaining whatever it is you long for. Observe how rich people get robbed, how generals get killed, and relatives separated. People crave the most lavish food and alcohol and kill their fellow sentient beings to fulfill their desire for meat, even though in the end it all just turns to excrement. So that's a contemplation we could do as we're enjoying our next meal. Like the trouble we go to, right, to get the exact food that we want. Actually, Lama Norla Rinpoche talked about that one time. He talked about going to restaurants with Western people. And, you know, we have so much choice in the West. Like, not only which restaurant to go to, but which food to pick off the menu. And he said, sometimes we have so much trouble deciding which is the exact thing that we want. And we're really disappointed if they don't have the exact thing. And we can't decide between this and that and the other entree. And we spend all of this time and mental effort on it. And then, of course, as Dingo Chensei Rinpoche says, it all comes out to the same thing in the end. So he found that very amusing. He always knew what he wanted to eat in a restaurant. So Dingo Chensei says, you could easily spend all your time trying to get rich enough to fulfill a taste for expensive clothes and the pleasure of owning more material goods. Craving, by its nature, brings only trouble and dissatisfaction. So, pop quiz here. Somebody can answer, or not. Marilyn's not here, so maybe nobody wants to answer it. But what other verse have we heard that in quite recently? Craving, by its nature, brings only trouble and dissatisfaction. So that would be verse 21, the last verse before we got to the ultimate bodhicitta verses. That's the one that says, sense pleasures and desire are like salt water. The more I drink them in, the more I crave. So the solution is to just drop them. Like as soon as that desire arises, I must have this thing. That's the solution. Think of it as like salt water. And yeah, you might get it, as Dingo Chensi has just pointed out in a bunch of examples. But holding on to it is trouble, and you always want more. So just like salt water. So there's really no point in exerting all of this effort to get what we want and to increase our material goods and so forth. So he says, the outer world and its living inhabitants are all impermanent. That's like the bottom line we always come back to. Your mind and body are together for the time being, but the mind is like a guest and the body like a hotel, in which that guest will only be making a short stay. So pop quiz number two. What verse have we heard that in? And that takes us all the way back to the preliminaries, verse four, letting go of attachment to this lifetime. Starting out with, we have to give up all our friends, we have to give up all of our material possessions, they'll be enjoyed by somebody else. Even our body is, even our mind is gonna leave the body. So Dingo Chensi makes that point again in terms of verse, in the context of verse 23. He says, once you truly understand that, and this is why, you know, the teachers keep hammering away at these same points. We have like three verses on it in the 37 verses already. Once you truly understand this, the seeming reality of your ordinary ambitions will fall away, and you will realize that the really meaningful thing to do for the present and the future is what? Let's all take a moment and see if we can come up with the answer to that. What is the really meaningful thing we can actually do instead of chasing after more stuff? It is to practice the Dharma, says Dingo Chensei Rinpoche. And here we are. That's what we're doing. So next up is Kempo Sultram Jamso Rinpoche, which is where I get all of the original Tibetan to do the translation. He says of this verse, all sense objects are like rainbows that, though beautiful and desirable, are mere appearances that lack essence. Where have we heard that before? That our experiences and the objects we crave lack essence. We heard it in verse 19. That was the verse where you have everything you want. Your richest Croesus, remember that one, which we changed to rich beyond our very wildest dreams. There's no point in gathering wealth because it has no essence. There's no point in being ambitious for success because it has no essence. And he explained to us at the time what having no essence means. Let's take a moment and just see if we remember what it means that all of these things that we experience in our lives have no essence. And we come back to that same bottom line again, that all roads lead to, which is impermanence. They're all impermanent. They're all subject to change, and they're all dependent on conditions. They don't have any, you know, what the Lugpas call inherent existence. So all sense objects are like rainbows that, though beautiful and desirable, are mere appearances that lack essence. If we believe otherwise, our desire to cling to a desirable object will increase and our suffering will grow in equal measure. So that's the downside, is like, even if you get the thing, it's the razor blade with honey on it. Like, it's going to lead to suffering in one way or another. Once the object is understood to be empty of essence, it can be enjoyed without clinging, without suffering. So what is there to give up? So Ken MacLeod is going to make this same point in a very vivid way in his commentary. We can still enjoy all of these things that we enjoy. We don't have to give up the things themselves. necessarily, unless, I mean, I think in the case of addictions, for example, we might have to think about giving up the thing itself if we can. But short of like a harmful addiction that hurts oneself and others, we can just enjoy things. But the key to really enjoying them without, you know, the pitfall of later suffering is to remember as we're enjoying them that they have no essence, that they're impermanent, they're subject to change, they're dependent on conditions. And another story that Lamanorla Rinpoche used to tell is that, and I remember this, when Kala Rinpoche would come to visit, people would take him to the circus, like somehow the circus always seemed to be in town. And, you know, and we did, as Westerners, we had this idea that our lamas needed to be entertained. They would love the same entertainments that we love. So I remember people took Lamanorla Rinpoche to see the Star Wars, one of the Star Wars movies. And he kind of enjoyed like all of the, you know, all of the booming and flying around and things. But he said Kala Rinpoche enjoyed the circus. It's not that he didn't enjoy the circus, but he, even as he was watching it, no matter what was happening, he always was remembering it was impermanent. So that's the key to being able to enjoy things without backlash. So in this way, back to Kempo Sultram Jansa Rinpoche, in this way, all forms, sounds, smells, tastes, and tactile objects have no self-nature. They are absolutely empty of essence. Though from the absolute perspective they do not truly exist, still they appear as mere appearances. So we're back to that dichotomy of like saying that things have no existence, no self-existence, but it doesn't make those things go away. They still have relative reality. So he says the apparent contradiction here is called appearance and emptiness inseparable. Why do we not, and this is key, a key point coming up, why do we not see this universal quality of the inseparability of appearance and emptiness of phenomena? It is because our minds are obscured by the idea that phenomena exist, and this thought covers up their true nature. So we might think that we're over that. Like we've been practicing and studying Buddhism for a really long time. We understand its appearance and emptiness inseparable. We understand it doesn't have any reality. But the fact is, the way that we can tell if we still have that kind of attachment is if things make us suffer. If we really have complete understanding of this and we really have no attachment to things, we're not going to suffer. Because attachment is, like the basic definition of attachment really is wanting things to be different than they are. And if we don't have that, then nothing can make us suffer because we're always content with things the way they are. Things come and go and it doesn't bother us in the slightest. So if we notice that we're suffering, it's really helpful to go back to these verses. Or, you know, you don't even have to pick up the paper and go to the verses. You can just, the suffering itself could be your mindfulness bell, like your trigger that you're losing sight of the ultimate reality perspective of things and the essencelessness of all of our experiences, that they're, of course they're impermanent. Of course it's not gonna last. Of course it's dependent on conditions, like a rainbow, and you take away one condition and the whole thing collapses. Everything is gonna unfold like that in our experience. And if we understand that, then it's not gonna hurt us. So now he's gonna give us to finish that thought, Kempo Sultram says, our minds are veiled by concepts. So our ideas about things are between us and the actual direct experience itself, which we can experience without the backlash of suffering. It's our ideas about the things that make us suffer. So again, if you think that you're beyond conceptuality about something, notice if you're suffering at all. And that might be a clue that you still have like some work to do that you could do on the spot. So now Kempo Sultram is gonna give us the example that makes all of this extremely clear, and he always uses this example. All appearances are like a dream. When we dream, objects clearly appear to us, but when we analyze these dream appearances, we see that they do not exist apart from our mind. So it's really easy to see this when we look at a dream. It seems so real, but when we wake up, we understand it had no existence anywhere. There's nowhere, it doesn't exist anywhere in space. You can't locate it. You can't say where it is. Our task, so nevertheless, they manifest as appearance, right? Dream appearances. They manifest as appearance and emptiness inseparable. Much easier to understand in terms of a dream. Our tasks are to dismantle the idea that appearances truly exist and to become free from conceptual obscurations, those concepts again, that veil how things really are, that are between us and direct perception of how things really are. In this way, the empty nature of appearance will manifest and our life will become relaxed, open, and spacious. So there is an alternative to grasping onto things in a way that comes back to bite us as suffering. If we understand its appearance and emptiness, if we understand that it's essenceless and it's going to be impermanent and so forth, then we can relax and our mind can be open and spacious and content, I would add. So he says, then no matter what desirable objects appear to us in waking life, our enjoyment of them can be free of pain, affliction, and all disturbing emotions. Once we are able to do this, we have fulfilled the 23rd practice of a bodhisattva. So I never really thought of that until I read this line, that we could like have a checklist. We could use the verses as a checklist and check them off when we complete them. Like, right, yeah, study, contemplation, meditation, I'm doing that 24/7, got that one. Given up all of my friends that harm my Dharma practice, no problem. I've let go of attachment to everything, no problem. I see everything as a rainbow. So you could check them all off. That could be your bucket list. That would be a really worthwhile bucket list. I don't know how many we could really check off, but, you know, I think that's true of many, many bucket lists. You can't really check them all off, but you try, and there's kind of an enjoyment in trying. So that was Kempo Siltram Jongso Rinpoche. And now we're going to look at Ken McLeod for a little bit. Does anybody have any questions or comments at this point before we go on? Anything they'd like to share? Okay, then we're going to... Oh, there's the cat, Dan's cat. All right, so I'm just skipping about halfway through Ken McLeod's commentary. So he says, on the one hand, everything you experience is real, if only because you experience it. On the other hand, nothing is real, because you cannot pin down anything you experience and say exactly what it is. So this is the same guy who gave us the meditation in the previous verse. You can't say where any experience is actually taking place. So here he expresses the same thing a little differently. Things happen to us. We see objects. We experience all kinds of phenomena. And in that sense, it's real, but we can't pin it down in any way. We can't ever say exactly what it is or where it is. He says, this is one of the great paradoxes of the human condition. The challenge is to live in the paradox, in the mystery, in that space where you cannot say, and you're comfortable with not being able to say. And Mingyur Rinpoche said the same thing. I heard him recently saying that our minds, like when we're living in relative reality, and I'm paraphrasing here, when we're in relative reality and we're kind of caught up in that, our minds get very narrow. And then when we rest in the nature of mind, our minds open up and are very expansive and relaxed and not stuck in yes or no. Same thing Ken's talking about. You can't say, not stuck in yes or no. And you get comfortable living in that space. And that is the space where you can connect more directly. Like it's a non-conceptual space where you can connect much more directly with the way things really are, the way they exist. You see them in an unconfused way that is not tainted by suffering. I mean, it's a process. Like it's a process. We're not going to be able to do it all at once, but we could work on it. And Pema Chodron quite often talks about getting out of our comfort zone, like learning to be comfortable, so to speak, in discomfort, like in not being able to say, in not being yes or no. Like how many situations did we encounter today alone where you couldn't say yes or no? Like, you can't pin down either what happened or what the solution is. And what if we just gave up trying to do that? You know, within reason, obviously, you have to deal with, like, material situations. But so much of them is sort of like, you know, we're just dealing with the tip of the iceberg, and we can't really get to the iceberg. And so if we're comfortable with that, we have so much less to do, less work to do, and less grief in doing it. So the challenge is to live in the paradox, in the mystery, and not try to make it not a paradox and not a mystery. And I myself, I love a good resolution. Like, I live for the resolution. So this is my challenge, is to not try to resolve things. I remember years and years ago, you know, we were working on translations or something and trying to make things really clear. And that's my particular thing. It's like, I want things to be like really crystal clear. And Long Norma just looked at me and said, sometimes things too clear. And I think that's like, it's a false clarity. It's a false resolution. Like, by pinning something down to be a particular thing, you lose a lot of the scope of the reality of it. And that is one of my particular faults in how I experience life. And that's something I'm working on continually when I remember. Most of the time, I'm just stuck in it. So I was only going to read that much of Ken, but since we didn't chant all the verses, we bought ourselves a little more time. And I'm going to read a little bit more of Ken, because he's actually going to share with us some thoughts about how we could enjoy our experiences without getting stuck in attachment to them. So he says, and he gave some examples above, but he's kind of going to say them again. So take any of the examples above, or take one of your own. And he's talking about an experience that just, you were so immersed in that experience, it was just like this perfection of experience. And I know I've had a few of those myself where you just, I think you almost do merge with the experience and you lose that sense of subject-object duality and you just sink into it. And there is a perfection to that. So he says, take any of the examples above or take one of your own, a moment when a work of art, a landscape, the company of a friend, or a rich red wine by a warm fire filled you with happiness and joy. So maybe we could take a moment and, you know, see if we can remember a moment in our lives when we had that experience. Maybe something recently, maybe not 100% perfect, but just a good moment, like a real moment of enjoyment of something where everything just felt right. And if you can't come up with any, no worries, you know, we'll take a hypothetical one. Looking at a rainbow is a really easy one because you never want the rainbow to go away. I remember just before I came out, around the time I came out of 3-year retreat, Jombard ran in, you know, like we hadn't seen iPhones and we hadn't seen viral video. She had to explain to us what it meant for something to go viral. And something had just gone viral and she brought it in and showed us. And it was about 2011. It was a video of a guy like in a cowboy hat or something who was seeing a double rainbow. And he just went, it's a double rainbow. And he just kept going on and on about it. So, you know, it's like that kind of like immersion and thrill. And then the rainbow starts to go and like, you're so sad. So I felt bad for the guy that the double rainbow was going to disappear. But anyway, so we have this moment of total connection. And Ken says, at that moment, you feel complete, full, and at one with the world. Rest there. So let's say we're having that experience now. Rest in that feeling. Rest there, feeling that fullness, relaxed and open. So that's the first thing, is like to really be present to the experience, which we so often aren't. You know, just really tune in to the experience. Let go of all the thinking and let go of all the wishes and the hopes and expectations about it and just tune into what it feels like that enjoyment. You actually get to enjoy it that way. So let's take a moment and just feel that sense of enjoyment of this wonderful class that we're all so happy to be in, for example, when it just feels perfect and right. Or the glass of wine by the fire is okay too. And he says, now feel what happens when that moment passes. And we all know what that moment feels like. It starts to just, the sunset, it's such a beautiful, I see the sunrise outside my living room window every morning. And there's just this peak moment and a beautiful sunrise. And you're just like, that is so perfect. And you just want to like immerse yourself in it. And then within seconds, you can just see it start to go away. And there is always a little feeling of wishing that it would, at least for me, wishing that it could just stay like that. So now feel what happens when that moment passes. You start down the, I'm going to skip all that. It's just describing for each of these situations, like what the passing moment is. He says, your attention then at that point, when it starts to go away, your attention collapses down to the memory, to the object, like you sort of grab onto it and you try to cling to it, to the memory of it, to the object. You try to keep it intact. He says, you want to bring it back, hold on to it and keep it a little longer, just a little longer. You want that person, that landscape or that painting back in your life. And it was, for me, it was literally a painting. That's one of the most vivid ones in my life. I was in Florence in 1976, Florence, Italy, at the Uffizi Gallery. And there was like this painting by Raphael. And I just merged with that painting. And I still remember that feeling so vividly and this sort of feeling of like, oh, now I have to go on to the next painting. So you want that person, that landscape, or that painting back in your life. You do not feel complete without it. You are complete, but you do not feel that way because you are no longer experiencing the wholeness of it. You are not including the change that has taken place in your feelings and your awareness. So you're trying to shut that out and just hold on to that feeling of completeness that you had for that moment. Instead of expanding your awareness to allow for the dissipation of it to be part of the ongoing and continuing experience. You close down to what you are experiencing right now because your attention is absorbed by what was instead of opening to what is. So what do we do with that? Like, how could we sort of elegantly segue into the next moment without feeling a sense of loss? Ken's going to give us some advice about that. He says, apparently we're still thinking back to something in our life that felt whole like that. So he says, recall the landscape, your friend, or the painting, or the glass of wine. Let yourself feel the longing in your heart and the way it arises in your body, the holding and the hoping, all at the same time. So you allow yourself to really feel whatever emotion it is that you're feeling. You get to feel the longing. You get to feel the sense of loss beginning. You hold all of it. You allow all experience to be present in your mind. Sensations, feelings, and thoughts arise and dissolve in the space of mind like rainbows in the sky. Let them be there. Visceral, sensual, ecstatic. If you wish, so it's optional, if you wish, pose the question, who or what knows all of this? So this is the one we always come back to. It's like we analyze our experience or we look at our experience and ask questions about it. And then we can ask, who is it anyway? Who's the guy behind the curtain? Is there a guy behind the curtain? Can I locate that? So that's always can be part of the process. And actually, to come back again to Lama Narla Rinpoche, he wrote or he gave a teaching in Charlottesville in the early 2000s that was written up in a magazine. I think Lama Willa wrote an article about it for this little magazine that had a few issues and then went away, another rainbow. And he said, he talked about how to rest in the nature of mind as you're doing taking and sending, which is very relevant to this text. And I think we've probably talked about it before, that like when you breathe in the suffering, like at the end of the inhalation, you ask, who's inhaling the suffering? Who's doing this? And at the end of the exhalation of happiness, you know, to all beings, you rest for a moment in like, who's doing this? So it brings you right back to the perspective of the nature of mind and the potential of the non-dual way of experiencing what you're experiencing. So Ken finishes by saying, the way that you experience the tug of the longing changes if you do it this way, if you allow the whole experience. The way that you experience this longing changes. Both the longing and the tug become sensations, physical and emotional. At the same time, you experience a stillness inside. You become aware of something that's still, that's constant inside. A quiet, deep feeling that does not depend on anything. And the memory, the perfect landscape or the perfect painting and so forth, you just appreciate and enjoy it without being disturbed by the longing for it. So you don't have to give up. Well, I guess what he's saying is you don't have to give up like feeling sad that it's gone. That can be part of the experience too. You just move on to what comes next. Anybody got any questions or comments before I share with you the thrilling questions and answers from Permanent Children? Oh, Deidre, I knew I could count on you. What you got?
Well, for me, it was, I don't remember how it came about, but I started looking at things that had happened in the past. And, you know, I don't know I'm sure everyone's seen this painting, you know, where there's the ocean and the ship, and then there's the end of the earth. And the ship, you know, they don't show the ship going off. But for me, it was in reverse, where all the past was that way. It just dropped away. There was nothing to find.
Right. As you were looking at the past.
Yeah. There was no sensation, no physical entity, no nothing that remained in the past. It was very interesting. It was so visceral, you know. It was just like to see it and feel it. But none of it. There's nothing left.
Yeah.
So moment by moment, that's happening. So each moment drops.
Yeah. It's like the bridge, like self-destructing behind you as you're going across the chasm, right? Like in the cartoons.
The domino effect.
Yeah. But that is the key, actually. It sounds like what you did was you were really looking at it, like sort of in an undistracted way. You're just looking at your past experience, because that does seem to be the key in all the teachings, is whatever experience arises, we look directly at it. And it turns out to be empty, or to be neither yes nor no, or you can't say.
Yeah, I think it was a... I think it was something, it could have been from Kenpo Tsultra and Rinpoche, about time, past, present, and future, you know, looking at actually just trying to dissect time.
Oh, yeah, he does that so well.
Yeah, and I think that was where that came from.
Yeah. Well, the teachings are really, really helpful. They're really useful. All these Buddhist logic teachings where that's what he really specializes in, is proving there's no past, proving there's no future, and then proving there's no present. So where does that leave you?
Laughing.
Laughing. It leaves, and that's where it leaves him.
There's nothing else to do at that point.
Yes. Because he's just proved that nothing exists at all. Like there's nothing you can pin down to say it's the past or the future or the present. You just can't say. I love that line from Ken MacLeod's meditation. You can't say. We can just rest in that. Like anything that happens to you, just use that phrase, I can't say. And that's how you rest in the paradox, as Ken puts it.
Yeah.
Anybody else? Joanne.
I find that the past is a great teacher. I think it really enlivens my practice that I'm not going to repeat those same mistakes. I'm not going to have that same perception that I'm, not to use the word enlightened, but in a way it is. I'm kind of seeing it in a different way, in a more enlightened, awakened way.
Yes. Great. Well, it does seep in kind of gradually. We get glimpses.
I think there's nothing wrong with regrets. I think regrets kind of strengthen us.
Yeah.
And again, having been a teacher, I always say mistakes are wonderful opportunities to learn.
Yes.
You're on an immense learning curve.
Yes. The Buddhist teaching, though, is at least in the moment, like when the regret arises, you feel it. You really allow it. Like, yes, I did that thing, and I really wish I hadn't done it, and I hurt somebody. And then you let it. You resolve never to do it again, and then you drop it. So you don't have to. It doesn't have to become like a guilt trip that you carry around. It's like a genuine regret, and that is part of the process of sort of purifying our certain kinds of conceptuality that keep us from being in the moment.
Thank you.
So thank you for sharing that, Joanne. And yes, Fanny, we're gonna unmute you.
Hi. It's such a kind, like path to be able to see the triggers, you know, of immersing with a moment. And there's so many of those. You know, I recently found $800 of somebody's check, and I knew that she was probably freaking out that her check was lost, if she even noticed that. And, you know, just the joy of trying to track that person down and going to the bank and seeing, you know, how to get that to this person without her knowing that I did it. You know, I just got it back where it was supposed to be. But then the freedom, you know, that just felt very, I don't know, purposeful. But then, you know, then when other triggers that get, that I can feel constricted, I feel very grateful to kind of look directly at that and just get some more space around it. There's so much habit of like a report card mentality of like when things are going well, you're riding high and, you know, dedicating the merit. When things are not, then so there's a liberation in knowing that that's doable and workable. And I'm grateful to, you know, all my Dharma community for that. Yeah.
Yes. Thank you for sharing that, Annie. It's really great to be able to hear your voice this week.
I know. I'm trying to get it on my home computer. Well, thank you.
Best wishes to all your patients.
Oh, yeah. They're pretty extraordinary. Thank you.
All right. Anybody else have anything? All right. Then we'll go on to Pema Chodron. Dan, you didn't have something, right? Okay. All right. Just checking. Don't want to miss you if you do. All right. So departing from verse 23 per se, we're going to go to a series of questions that Pema Chodron took after she did the ultimate bodhicitta. And she did the whole text in one weekend, basically four sessions. So she went through it a lot faster. She skipped over a lot of things. And she took a lot of questions, which really, you know, further limited the time she had to actually go over the verses themselves. But of course, the questions and answers are often like the real pith of it anyway. So the first question of these three questions that I'm going to share, someone was talking, and I just took notes, so it's not all, I didn't get the whole question, for example, but it had to do with someone talking about at the place where she works, there's a culture of hate and competitiveness. And she says, I do Tonglen when I have an emotional reaction, but how do I know when to speak up? So that comes back to the question that always arises, like, do we just do Tonglen and leave it at that, or do we intervene in things? And the answer is always we intervene, you know, when we need to, when the situation requires an intervention, then we don't hesitate to intervene. You want to be very careful, of course. And that's what she's going to talk. I won't try to get ahead of her, but we'll just read what she says. So she says, as a foundation, one has to be in touch with what one is feeling. If the person or you, if you're doing Tonglen, then you are probably in touch with this, like what you're feeling. That's the most important part, actually. So Tonglen actually helps to bring you into, this is me paraphrasing again, or adding. So the doing Tonglen is an important part of whatever you're going to do in this situation, this bad situation at work. And it brings you in touch not only with your own feelings, but also with, like, helps you get in touch with the feelings of whoever's being a terrible person at that time. And she says, So you do the tongue lens, that's important. And then you ask how much of your reaction is a storyline that you've been carrying throughout your life. Does the situation echo earlier situations in your life? It may be a terrible workplace, but to get in touch with how much of it is your overlay, your story, your personal history, your conceptual limitation is also important. So we have to analyze in terms of that. Like, is it really all coming from the other side, or am I bringing something to this that's increasing my discomfort and my distress? She says, if you have friends at work, how do others perceive the same thing? So you could get a reality check, or if you're the only one who's having this overreaction, then that's another important piece of information. He says, all of that is really helpful information to gather. So you do the tongue lens, you analyze the situation a bit, like how much of this is really objectively something that is wrong and needs to be intervened with. She says, at some point, sooner or later, you may feel that you have to stop what's happening right now. Then it comes back to what I've been saying. What helps people in their work and family situations is you have a commitment to not polarizing the situation or dehumanizing the people who make these rules, the bosses, other coworkers. You have a commitment to not labeling them. So this is really huge. You know, it's like we're taking that moment to disengage our emotions and not react out of an emotion, but to ask ourselves, how can I actually make the situation better instead of just making it a fight? So you refrain from, like, can we do that with someone who really drives us crazy? For example, in politics, you know, if we look at politics, if we look at government, we're very polarized right now. Could we look at the other side and not label them, but genuinely try to see them as a human being and see how we could actually work with them? She says, you want to experiment in how could you speak in a way that possibly could be heard. And then some effective change could take place. If we're not labeling, we're not polarizing, we're trying to speak in a way that the other person wouldn't just get their hackles and their defenses up, but they could actually hear it, which usually involves acknowledging, from my experience, it usually involves acknowledging their point of view. Chet, did you have something you wanted to say, or are you just, okay. Right, being open to hearing them. Yes, Fanny.
The other night I went to hear the K.D. Lang concert, and she's apparently been a practicing Buddhist, and she actually did Tung Len with the audience, and everyone was like, oh, this is so cool. She goes, she invited the audience after her third set to dissolve hatred and division and unite and diversity, and then brought it into the heart space. And I go, oh my God, she's doing Tung Len to the audience. It was extraordinary. And I'm not sure how many people connected that. The group I was with talked about how powerful a practice, not practice, but powerful a intention that was. So
yeah.
I wanted to say, when you mentioned Tonglin, it reminded me of the other night. Yeah.
It's great when people use a platform that they have been given.
In a conscious way,
That is just what Pema Chodron's saying, to get people, like, step out of polarization and out of easy labeling and out of their defensive postures and be open. To get rid of polarization, like, both sides have to give something up. It's not like the other side is always going to be the one, or that the other side should be the one to back down. It's like everybody's got to engage. So she said, and so this is what can happen if we contribute to the polarization. She says, so often there's an unjust situation, like a genuinely unjust situation, and there's a lot of people now, and a lot of Buddhists working on social justice, for example. And she says, and what replaces the unjust situation is an almost fundamentalist view of what's correct in the situation. And it's just as fixated. Minds are just as closed. You don't want to replace one wrong with another wrong. Two wrongs do not make a right. So it just doesn't help to come at things, you know, in a more polarizing way, or to replace one rigid system with another rigid system is what Chitterman is suggesting here. So that's the first question and answer. And I thought it was really helpful as a way to frame like how to actually work with a situation that does need something to change, as well as working with our meditation practices and our bodhisattva intentions internally. So second question is another question that arises a lot, and I think we probably talked about it in this class. The question is, how is observing without grasping or aversion, how is that not indifference? This is confusing to me, says the person. So Pema Chodron says, we're talking about not speaking or acting out of your attachment or aversion. You still feel what you feel. Indifference means turning away, not feeling, trying to dangle above, like whatever the emotions are. Your child dies. Just like in the example which she's talking about, those verses, that's the next verse. Your child dies and you're a pure spiritual person because you don't get upset. Ridiculous, you know. I mean, even Marpo was like heartbroken when his son died. And people said to him, but you're a great spiritual teacher. Why are you experiencing grief? And he said, and Marpo answered, he was a really special person. Like, of course he experienced grief, even though he was a completely realized teacher. So ridiculous, you know, not to have any emotion when something really terrible happens. Or someone is torturing an animal and you don't get outraged because, you know, you're above that. She says, instead, what we're talking about is owning the feelings that you're feeling. It's the opposite of indifference. It's very heartfelt and raw. When you are fully in touch with what it's bringing up for you, there's an opportunity to act and speak out of some kind of sanity, something that doesn't polarize. So we don't speak and act out of the emotion, out of being in the grip of the emotion. It's the same practice. We see it as a rainbow. We see it as no essence, like it's just an emotion arising. We look at it, and Kathy always has this one, but I never remember exactly what the wording is. You face it and you... Trungpa's word is stomp on it, you know, but you allow the emotion to dissipate, or you see through it to the underlying nature of reality. And then you can speak or act from a place of sanity that while you still feel the emotion, you're not controlled by the emotion. She says, I think it's a misunderstanding, skipping the part about knowing how you feel about it. It's an important part of the process. But acting and speaking out of it is usually unconscious, so it makes matters worse because we're stuck in the emotion. It digs the whole thing deeper if we do that. It doesn't bring harmony or healing to the situation. So again, that helps clarify it, I think, you know, for me. Like, we're not suppressing an emotion. We're not denying an emotion, and it's not that we're not supposed to feel it, because often we think maybe we're not supposed to feel that way. And I think when we have a certain amount of realization, maybe we really don't. But for us, it's okay. Whatever comes up, it's okay to feel it and acknowledge it. And then we have our remedies to ensure that we don't speak or act out of it and cause harm in some way to ourselves and others. So the third question, okay, this one's really good too, but I'm probably going to just read part of the answer. I marked part of the answer. So this person says, when I read this book, meaning the 37 practices, I was like, there's no way I'll ever become a bodhisattva. She says, verses 12 through 18, that's a bodhisattva boot camp, the humdinger verses, as she calls them, and this is the questioner, address affronts to the individual person. My issue is more about affronts to humanity, situations like 9/11 or the Holocaust. She says, I do pit bull rescue. Some of the cruelty I've seen is soul-crushing. My feeling is not revenge, but I do feel people like that should be polarized, exterminated. Sexual abuse of young children, serial killers, people with no redemptive qualities, these people are dangerous to society. They are evil. They're not just someone who said something bad about you on Facebook. She says, I don't know how not to polarize. This triggers me uncontrollably. Can you help me become a bodhisattva? Great question. And Pema Chodron says, it's such a heart wrencher. Can you in that situation not hate, not polarize? let's take a moment, can we? Like, what? Can we? Something that bad, we're confronted with something that terrible. Torture of animals, abuse of children, extermination of populations. Can you address that without polarizing and without hating and without wanting to exterminate in return? So Pema Chodron says, well, a bodhisattva would, of course, say yes, right? And she says, I also would say yes, but it's challenging to exactly know how to proceed. That's your dilemma, she says. A bodhisattva would probably recognize that to put an end to that forever, to really stamp out those kinds of behaviors, is impossible, because the people who take pleasure in hurting others are so deeply wounded themselves, and almost in all cases have been badly abused themselves. However, so we probably can't fix it. But she says, however, could you dedicate your life to trying? That's the bodhisattva ideal. Pitbull, that's a word that people label. This might sound silly, but knowing how people feel about pit bulls and put pit bulls into the class of evil. She says that's a story, that's propaganda. But when you look at that, you realize that the breed is labeled unjustly. Maybe you could realize you're labeling unjustly too. If you wanted to, by the end of the year, if you wanted to have helped 7 people stop harming animals through starting some kind of support group for people who already want to stop, but it's a compulsion, could you do that? She says, it's just hypothetical here, but if that focus could shift to trying to help the perpetrators not do it anymore, she says, hating them, calling them evil is not changing anything. And I read actually a while back about a black man who, was it a black man? I think there's different stories. One's a black man and one's a white man who used to be in a white supremacist group. But this, I think that either of them, what they decided to do was not fight the white supremacists, but to approach them individually and talk to them and hear their side and hear their story. And in both cases, they were able to befriend these people. And that made so much more of a difference in their overall attitude. It didn't necessarily stop them from having their beliefs, but it stopped them from applying them sort of universally. I don't know. I mean, I would have to go back to it. But I found that such an inspiring story. Like, this is this person's way of dealing with racism. You know, as a victim of racism, their way of dealing with racism is to try to talk to the racists individually and share their stories and just see what happens. And Pema Chodron's not saying that this necessarily works, but it is a way. It's a way of approaching constructively with a constructive intention that's not meeting anger with anger and force with force. So she says, hating the perpetrators and calling them evil is not changing anything. You could get a lot of people on your team who would actually go after them, you know, join you in the fight, but it would just intensify the situation that causes the problem. A bodhisattva has the intention to eliminate the problem, but with the realization that they can't eliminate it. That is basically the plight of the bodhisattva. They know that they can't fix it, but they keep trying. They keep doing their best. They keep making whatever little inroads they can make. Or as the 16th Karmapa is quoted in a meme that's made the rounds of Facebook a few times, has said, you just keep going. That's the way of a bodhisattva. So if your goal is one person, if one person stops, then you're using your life to actually stop the problem. So you see, like, you understand that the scope of the difference you can make may be small, but that doesn't discourage you from doing what you can. So those are the... those are the questions and answers from Pema Chodron. And we have a couple of minutes left. Does anybody have anything they want to say before we do prayers? I have a note here. So this is sort of the homework. And we're not going to meet next week because I'll be at KTC helping with the memorial service. And we're not going to meet the 29th. I put this in my emails the last couple of days. because I'm not sure when I'm getting back and I may not have time to prepare. So we'll plan to meet in 3 weeks, April 5th, and we will pick up with verse 24 there and complete Ultimate Bodhicitta. So that gives us 3 weeks to work with Ultimate Bodhicitta as we have studied it so far. And so I'm going to suggest that for the next 3 weeks, we really try to tune in and remember and recognize when we're meeting an enjoyable experience, be it a rainbow or an ice cream cone or a good TV show or anything. When you meet an enjoyable experience, when you feel happy, recognize it as what being like a rainbow and apply the analysis that Kempo Sultram Jamsa Rinpoche has given us. Like, in what way is this like a rainbow? In what way does it have no essence? Like, if we could remember that, yes, I'm enjoying this fabulous meal, but it has no essence. It's going to be over soon. It's going to turn to excrement. You know, it's impermanent, it's subject to change, it's dependent on conditions, you can't hold on to it. If we can remember any one of those things as we're enjoying something, that's huge. We can also apply taking and sending to it by sending. You don't have to do the taking part at that point, but whenever we encounter something enjoyable, we could remember to send it, you know, to all beings. We can follow Ken MacLeod's advice, let ourselves enjoy it, knowing it will change or end. Recognizing that it's a set of conditions that are coming together in a specific moment, just like a rainbow. As it starts to fade or comes to an abrupt end, you notice that you want to hold on to it, and you consciously connect with that stillness, that vast awareness that doesn't change, and you let the relative experience fade and move on. So we can actually practice this. This verse gives us something we can actually practice in our daily life. And verse 22, we can keep practicing as well. Keep using Ken MacLeod's meditation if that resonates with you. Keep resting in, I can't say, not yes or no, it's not resolved. I don't need to resolve it. Like, what does it feel like unresolved? What does it feel like knowing that I can't fix this thing? Like, take the energy out of trying to fix it. You do what you can that needs to be done, but you back off from being frustrated, from having hopes and fears and expectations about you should be able to resolve this thing or fix this problem. Like, what does it feel like to just let the problem be and know that it's going to be and do whatever you can to cope with it? So that's the homework. Okay, anybody got anything before we now actually do the dedication? All right. So again, remembering all sentient beings throughout limitless space, each of them with suffering because we are all caught in samsara, and sharing with them whatever insights we may have gotten and the benefit of whatever insights we may have gotten from this discussion. This merit may it win omniscience, defeat my faults, the enemy. Then from the rough and stormy sea of birth, old age, death, and disease, from this ocean of samsara, may I liberate all beings. They know things in their true existence, Kuntu, Zangpo, and Manjushri. To train myself in their example, I dedicate this practice fully. May every being through this practice completely gather merit and wisdom, attaining the two sacred bodies, that merit and wisdom emanate, the blessings of the Buddhakayas, the blessings of changeless dharmata, the blessings of the steadfast sangha, this dedication please fulfill. So let our minds just come to rest in everything being like a rainbow, like a dream, present in our body in this present moment of awareness. I actually have a rainbow on my wall. All right, so let us keep Patrick and Marilyn in mind. Send prayers for Patrick to quickly, you know, his problems to quickly resolve. Let's hope that his health issues resolve in a good way and he gets home soon. All right, Mark Hoyer, can you stay on for a minute after we end the meeting?
Yes, I can.
Okay, great. I just have to work out some logistics with
you. Yeah, that's fine.
All right. Okay, everybody, I'm actually not going to end the meeting for everybody, so if you can end the meeting for yourself, that would be really fabulous. And if you have any trouble, I can end it for you. So see you April 5th, if not before. Hope to see some of you March 25th.
Edwin, children.
Yes, Anne.
I just have a question.
Yes.
Will the March 8th video be online at some point on your website?
Oh, is you mean that like of this class? Is it this?
Yes, of this recording of last week.
Oh, it's not up yet?
No.